Hence and grass. Ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na kaya ha ane kak. Gunnish cheesh.
From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan. It's Thursday, August 14th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunnith Cheesh, Hawa, Tuxik Nusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream for a behind-the-scenes look of what's going on here in the studio on YouTube at ktoo.org/jpmlive. Or on KTO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Conversations coming up this hour. We talk with the new executive director of St. Vincent de Paul, Jennifer Skinner, about programs, offerings, and how you can help. We continue our coverage of the glacial outburst flood with the premiere of the third episode of Outburst, the new podcast series from KTOO. This one intriguingly titled Bomb the Glacier. And we begin today with the new Strength in Family program from Clinkett and Haida Family and Elder Services. Clinkett and Haida is now enrolling tribal citizens and Native American families who are interested in this new family visiting program. What does that mean, and what is this service, and who is it for? Well, I've got two of the Clinkett and Haida family wellness coaches with me to share more about it and help us answer those questions. Welcome to you, Holly Adams. Gunnith Cheesh, Wasiyati. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm excellent. Thanks so much for joining us today. And Margaret Hobby. Gunnith Cheesh, Wasiyati. How are you, Margaret?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Excellent. Well, it's so nice to have you both here. Gunnith Cheesh, Haiyadi. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. So first, let's just talk about what is a family wellness coach. And I know that your work is under the Family and Elder Services, I guess, department at Clinkett and Haida, which encompasses many programs. And I love, by the way, the new website, clinkettandhaida.gov. You can go there. Everything's laid out very well. You can go to the Services tab, click on Family and Elder Services, and you'll see all of the things that Family and Elder Services do, various different programs. So your work, Margaret, how long have you been working with Family Services?
I started with the Family Wellness coach back in December with training, and then got certified as a family spirit educator from the Johns Hopkins University.
Oh, wow.
And then more recently with Motherhood is Sacred, and I'm facilitating that. Got certified from Native American Fatherhood and Family Association. So it's a fairly new program that started soft opening in March.
Okay, so this is an expansion into the sort of wellness coaching, and you were certified in all of that, which is kind of cool. Were you working at Clinkett and Haida before that in a different area?
Yes, I was. I started off as a behavioral health aide and then switched into the elders program with Clinkett and Haida.
I see. Okay. And what about you, Holly? How did you get involved with the family wellness coaching over there at Clinkett and Haida?
Well, I am a certified Indigenous birth worker, and that sort of led me into this position. And once I started working as a family wellness coach, I was certified as well as a family spirit educator.
Okay.
And I am also completing my lactation counselor certification training right now, so I'll be able to offer support to families who are breastfeeding, and support through pregnancy, birth, and postpartum, while also incorporating and supporting culture and tradition.
Wow. And you were on the show a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago,
yes.
It was, because you also run your own little store of baby stuff.
Yes, I am the owner of Muskeg Munchkins Baby Boutique in the Mendenhall Mall, which opened about a year ago. So
a year ago, okay.
Yeah, I was on the show about a year ago talking about that.
Well, it seems like this work then kind of leads into that. You're all about babies, it seems.
Yes, and mothers.
And mothers, yeah, because it's interesting. You said something about the first thing you said that you're a certified, it's a birth, what did you say, birthing coach?
Birth worker.
Birth worker. What does that mean?
I can offer support through pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. And I also, with that support, offer trauma-informed care and culturally competent care and bringing those in to the birthing process while also incorporating traditions and just supporting families in that process.
I see. Okay, that's really cool. I love that. So that's really great that all this training. And Margaret, sounds like you did a bunch of training through John Hopkins and other places. How was that training for you?
It was all very informational. I've done Motherhood is Sacred before when I first started with Clink and Ida.
Yeah.
And a lot of the parents that I've worked with came back and said that was very helpful for them because it built their self-esteem up. It helped them as an individual, a positive role model. And part of what I do with Family Spirit is I take their curriculum and we can modify it to add culture, to add the languages. So I'm enrolled to not only learn Tlingit, but also teach it. So I'm sitting there putting that in with our one-on-one family visits as well as parent gatherings.
Okay, that's
and
so cool.
So I get a harvest with them during the summer. We have future plans in the winter to do storytelling.
Okay.
We just have a lot of stuff we're planning around culture and adding that into Family Spirit.
That's
and
fantastic.
Motherhood is Sacred. It's already, it was from Al Pooley. He's Lower 48, so he was a founder of it, and he added all this culture and our values and already in the program. So that was, it connected with a lot of parents that I worked with.
Okay, that is really awesome. So this new program, Strength in Family, how did this come about, Margaret?
I was interested in this position as I read the job description and talking with my supervisor. I always wanted to work with parents and I've always wanted to do curriculums and that was part of the job description. So I sat there and I approached her and got hired.
Nice.
So I actually did a couple classes with her. One of them was the moccasin class making. And so we interacted that way and we interacted on the same floor. So it was something that I'm very passionate with.
So they had this program in mind as something they wanted to do. And in hiring you, sort of, it had its birth, as it were, in some ways. Yeah, that's kind of cool. So what does it involve? What is the program? I have a little flyer here which will describe it a little bit about what's going on with it. But what is the Strength in Family program?
It is a family enrichment program that we get to work with parents with both programs. I'm certified in both the Motherhood is Sacred and Family Spirit. And then we brought in Holly. She gets to more knowledge with the birth side of things. So we're really working with parents and getting them to find themselves again. As one of my first curriculums, that first meetings with one-on-one, we look at really dive into like the family tree and where they came from and who they are. So that's kind of building the foundation of the rest of our curriculum that we're going to be coming at the parents with.
Because this is all, it's going to be, I know I read in there, you know, it's like family visiting. What does that mean, Holly?
So it could mean a lot of different things. You know, we are really about meeting families where they're at.
Yeah.
But in our visiting, we offer like parenting, learning parenting techniques and strategies, insight into child development, trying to incorporate culture and tradition in parenting, in birth and pregnancy, assisting families in achieving their goals, connecting families with community and cultural resources. And then, of course, we also offer the parent gatherings with the cultural activities that Margaret was talking about.
I see. Okay. And I know, and this is for, is it mostly geared towards newer parents? I know it's for kids who are 0 to 3. Mm-hmm. We could say that. We need to let people know that. It's for those who maybe haven't had the child yet, because mm-hmm. that would be 0, I guess, up to 3 years old. So yes. We're talking about really early childhood development. Is it geared more towards new parents, or can this be anybody who's having a child or already has one?
I have a few of the families I'm working with that also have older children. So it's any tribal citizen that is pregnant and has children up to 3 years old.
Okay.
And so I have a lot of background working with kids as far as working in school districts and child care. So I bring that in with my experience and working with them, because sometimes they'll have issues of behavioral issues with older kids. So I get to pull in my experience from that and get to work with families. So
if you have if there's a parent or a set of parents out there who's having a new baby or has a young child already, having like a 6-year-old doesn't make them disqualified for the program. They can still apply as long as they have somebody who's 0 to 3, right? Or going to be having a 0 to 3.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I love the idea of sort of folding in the culture and the language into the parenting, you know? And what kind of things what does that look like? What does that look like to do that, Holly, to sort of fold in some of the things? Or maybe this is a question for Margaret, better for you, in terms of how are you folding in the culture and the language into the sort of the parenting techniques?
A lot of parents and a lot of ones that aren't directly in contact with the language. So I get to come in and say the lessons about dressing the child or such, that I can sit there and add in words. So it's a little introduction, little by little, and exposes them to weekly sessions that we get to go in with. And I've built the curriculum to where it has language with the parents, so they get to learn little by little, so they're not fully overwhelmed by the language, because it is a hard language to learn.
That's me. I'm a little bit at a time, just a phrase or two here and there as it goes, right? So that's because it's interesting, because if you've been removed from it, which many tribal citizens have been, they've been removed, the language is taken from them. And so relearning that, getting that into, it seems like a great way to do it too, because you're doing it as a young child is learning too, right? So you're using maybe both English and Tlingit or whatever language that is, Haida, Tsimshian, whatever it is. That's really cool. So this is, and just as we said, this is for tribal citizens and Native American families.
Correct.
Okay. So how do folks get involved? I know, do they reach out to you via email? Do they call? What's the best way for a family? Because I know you're looking for more families, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So how do they get involved?
Our flyer does have contact information with the email and phone number. And I believe it's also on the website.
Yeah. So you can visit tlingit.gov/service/strength-and-family. And so our website is a great way to reach out to us to be enrolled or talk more about it if it's something you're interested in.
Okay. I love that it says here that the educational visits can be either in the home or a family room at Tlingit and Haida, or even at a park, it says, which I think is great. So it's really, you're kind of designing the activities and the function of this program around the family and what's best for them. Am I getting that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. That's really, really fun. I know it's been newer program, like you said, Margaret. What's been the best moment so far since you've launched?
Working with a few families, I've sat there and had parents, ask, because they're curious, what did I miss? What lesson did I miss? Mm-hmm. Can you bring that in the next session? So I'll bring it to the next session. So that we want parents to sit there and have that eagerness to learn more and be a better person, be a better role model. And then I've also had parents that sat there and, well, what about my child that has, you know, such and such issue? And so I bring my other experience in. So it's been very rewarding to sit there and work with parents, especially the ones that are eager to learn and want to know more information. They're also on the cultural side of things. They want to harvest. They want to learn. They want to sit there and be engaged, to be involved. So it's a lot of just all around great program.
Awesome. And Holly, what's your hope for the future of the program? What would you love it to be in like a couple years?
Wow. Well, you know, I really hope that we can reach more families and just be able to support them in, you know, how they want to have birth or raise their children, and just incorporating more traditions in that. And we're also trying to incorporate knowledge from our elders and learn from them in our parenting techniques and child rearing traditions. And I hope that we can also offer more Indigenous birth worker training to communities around Southeast so that there are more local resources for families as well.
Yeah, that would be great. Are you looking for more wellness coaches, you're looking for families mostly. You don't necessarily need more coaches yet. But maybe if the program keeps growing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Is there anything else that you want to mention about the program that we didn't get to? I just want to make sure that we covered it, because it feels like it's a very comprehensive program.
So Motherhood is Sacred is another program, because I feel like we've touched a lot on the family spirit side of things, but mm-hmm. Motherhood is Sacred is a 12-session program that runs 6 weeks long that some people are familiar with, but I ran it in 12 weeks, so we shortened it to 6 weeks.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that...
What does that program cover?
It looks more at the mothers and the individual strength that the program can bring to them. It focuses a lot on the mother themselves.
I see.
There's a different program that fathers can take. I know a facility is being trained to start with fathers, but not quite yet.
Close, yeah.
Yes.
And is it part of the Strength and Family program, or is
Correct.
It? So it's incorporated into that. Okay, I see. Okay, so there's many components underneath the Strength and Family program. Gotcha. Okay, that's awesome. Well, congratulations on the launch of this program and for getting your certifications and launching this. This seems amazing. Already working with some families and looking for more families. And if you're interested, you can actually go to the website, ClinkettandHaida.gov, and you can go to that services tab. You can find this program and reach out. You can also email familyvisits@ClinkettandHaida.gov if you want more information. That's familyvisits@ClinkettandHaida.gov. Holly, Margaret, thank you so much for coming in today. Gunnath Cheesh, for sharing this new program with us. It sounds really awesome. I want you to come back in like a year, and then maybe we'll have a family in here with a little baby, and we can talk about what the program is, and the baby will speak Tlingit or something. That would be kind of cool.
High hopes, yes.
That would be so fantastic. Well, Gunnath Cheesh, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Guyana, Boston.
Thank you. Up next, we're going to listen to this week's edition of Our Living Lands from Native Voice One. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As wildfires continue to increase in frequency and severity across the country, firefighters are in high demand. Lauren Patterson from Northwest Public Broadcasting reports on a new generation of Nez Perce firefighters in Idaho.
It's mid-morning and the beaming sun is hanging over Lapway, Idaho. At the fire station, it's casting shadows into the bays where three firefighters are checking over equipment on their fire truck.
We have a daily checklist every day we go through. And
That's Riston Bullock, who's getting ready for his 13th season on the crew. Jalisco Miles is to his right with the checklist. He's in his third year. And Pharrell Hayes, a rookie, looks on. Bullock starts pulling on a pump to clear out the water.
We check our pumps and stuff like that. And if we have any hose hanging on here, we'll take it off, replace it with new hose. We got all of our tires are good to go.
Miles starts marking off the list with a pen.
After last year, we had a really big fire, and it changed my perspective a lot on it.
For days, the Gwen fire blazed across the Clearwater Canyon, burning nearly 30,000 acres. There were multiple evacuation orders for people living in the small towns along the river. He says it made him realize how important the job is when lives are on the line. The experience focused him.
Getting there, making sure everything's okay, and getting to the call and keeping them small.
Hayes wanted to fight fire last summer, but he wasn't old enough.
Now it's my first year, so I'm excited for all that.
He's joined a crew of 8 firefighters who will spend the next 5 months on the front lines of local fire response. They've been getting around 2 calls a week, sometimes 3. Bullock says he does this job because he's dedicated to protecting the land and his community.
Now that I've been in fire for so long, it's kind of more being the first one to respond, put the fires out.
A big challenge here in Idaho and across the nation is that there aren't enough people to help.
We're losing firefighters. The numbers are going down.
People can still volunteer, but
we need people at the shop ready to go when those fires start.
Across from the shop in the air-conditioned office, Jeff Handel, the fire management officer, is on the phone trying to schedule repairs for fire trucks.
Okay, what I need is I've got a couple rigs that need radios put in.
He's also worried the younger generation doesn't seem too interested in firefighting.
It's pretty tough in today's world when you can get a job from work from home and do okay financially. Why would you want to go out and do the firefighting thing, which is very hard work?
After pushing for years, federal wildland firefighters got a permanent pay increase through a spending package passed by Congress in March.
Now, the minimum is 15 across the board, and in most places, it's more like $17 or $18 an hour.
Back at the shop, the firefighters are organizing equipment like ropes and hatchets. Bullock says the tribe does events with students and job fairs to try to get more people interested in firefighting as a career.
I always try to encourage them to try it for a year. See if you like it or not. See if, you know, if you want to do this, keep doing this.
Miles says one of the best parts of the job is the travel. Sometimes firefighters help fight blazes beyond their state lines.
My first year, right after graduation, I was driving across the Grand Canyon, heading to Arizona. My first time seeing that.
There could be changes coming to how the Nez Perce Tribal Fire Crew works with other agencies in the region. The Trump administration is trying to merge all federal firefighting into a single agency. That could mean shifting thousands of jobs around in the middle of fire season. Bullock says he's not sure how that would work.
I see it kind of being crazy because there's already one, it's called the Interagency Dispatch Office.
That office is based in northern Idaho. And Bullock says agencies like the Idaho Department of Lands and the U.S. Forest Service already work together and with the tribe.
I feel like it'll just kind of be a new name, but I still feel like we'll still have our shops and everything here. We'll be mixed out through each other, and it'll be, I don't know, it might be complicated.
For now, Bullock and the rest of the crew aren't giving it too much thought. They're busy getting ready for the next call. Reporting in Lapway, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Now we're going to take a listen to the next episode in the Outburst podcast series from KTOO, covering the glacial outburst flooding here in Juneau. This episode is intriguingly titled, Bomb the Glacier?
Okay, and try not to laugh. because people legitimately have asked this question. People have asked the question, right? Could you bomb the glacier?
That's Rory Watt, Juneau's city manager, in 2023. This was an actual conversation he had with Juneau Assembly members at a public meeting just weeks after that year's glacial outburst flood. An audience sat in the muggy room looking at a presentation slide with a photo of a bomb on it.
People started throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Figuratively. Bombs, ditches, siphons, and tunnels. Nothing was off the table. But some things probably won't work. Some options aren't physically realistic. David Poloshensky, the postdoc from episode 2, who's studying Mendenhall Glacier at the University of Alaska Southeast, says that ice resists explosives.
When you try to blow it up, it just smushes, if you will.
Of course, that hasn't stopped people from pitching the idea again and again.
Blow that whole side of the glacier off down far enough so that the water can never raise up again.
That's Marion Hobbs, whose family lost crops and an outhouse to a flood here in the early 1960s. He thinks it could even be a lucrative spectacle that people could watch from the lake.
I would charge $10 a ticket. I would sell tickets for everybody to go over by the skater's cabin.
Now, in 2025, as another flood is forecast to hit Mendenhall Valley soon, officials say every idea is still on the table. The end goal is to permanently protect the Mendenhall Valley community. Officials say that's going to take a lot of research, money, and time. Hundreds of people in Juneau's Mendenhall Valley are living on the front line of a climate change disaster they didn't see coming. From KTOO Public Media, this is Outburst, the story of how a freezing cold disaster has escalated faster than human imagination and public policies to protect people. I'm your host, Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO in Juneau. This is episode 3, Bomb the Glacier. Right now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is working on a report that gathers all the physical data about the valley. The study is federally funded. It costs nearly $5 million and will take a few years to finish. It will cover things like water flow dynamics and the geology underlying the lake and river. That study will inform another report called a feasibility study. That's where the Army Corps weighs each option and picks one. It could take another few years and millions of dollars more. After that, engineers have to design the solution they pick, which can take another couple of years. Then the Army Corps has to build it, which will take several more years, depending on how big it is. Add it all up, and residents could end up waiting a decade or longer for a permanent fix. That time-consuming approach for a long-term solution doesn't square with residents' anxiety about living with an annual flood that could be growing. At a public meeting with Army Corps staff in a school auditorium, many residents say they want the government to move faster.
If it takes 10 years, there won't be anybody left in the valley to benefit from all these studies.
That's Craig Logan. He lives on Emily Way, a street that got hit hard by the flood last August. He says the Army Corps' slow process is painful to watch. And one idea at the meeting got more attention than any other. A dam. Dave Hanna has lived in Juneau his whole life. He thinks a dam is a simple fix. So he went up to the microphone and told the Army Corps as much.
Find out what you've got to build on and then figure out how to build it, because we can't wait 7 years. We just can't do it.
Lots of residents agree with him. Glacial outburst floods aren't new to Alaska, but this is the first time the U.S. government has had to protect a community from them. Other countries have done this before. An estimated 15 million people live beneath the possible threat of glacial outburst floods around the globe. Most are in the Himalayas and the Andes. There are also towns at risk in Iceland, parts of Canada, and the European Alps. Switzerland, for one, has records of facing this very threat dating back centuries. In the 1800s, workers dug a tunnel through a glacier in the Swiss Alps in an attempt to protect people from a looming glacial outburst flood. 200 years later, the small town of Lenk, Switzerland, tried a similar tactic. Here's what happened. The Glacial Lake Faverge released an outburst flood in 2018 that hit some homes and covered farmlands in glacial silt. It wasn't deadly. Still, scientists saw that the lake was growing and predicted larger floods would follow. So Lank City officials hired an engineering firm called Geotest to come up with a solution. Isabel Cole, the project manager there, describes a process similar to what Juno is planning now.
So we made a list of all possibilities and we checked every possibility.
They weighed several options, including tunneling through the mountain and building a dam. Bombs were quickly ruled out. In the end, they decided to carve a trench through the ice that would continuously drain water from the lake. Cole says it was the cheapest and quickest option. It cost $2.5 million and took 2.5 months to dig. And so far, it's worked. The town hasn't flooded since. But there are some maintenance costs.
But what we did not expect, and that was really a problem, is that after the winter, it was full of snow.
Winter snow can block the trench. When that happens, they have to dig a new one. Cole says it costs nearly $400,000 per trench. And she says that because glaciers change so rapidly, solutions engineered in the ice are short-lived.
There will be a day where it doesn't work anymore because the lake is deeper and deeper, and one day you will not be able anymore to excavate at that level.
So they're talking about building a dam one day, which she says could cost $12.5 million and take 6 or so years to plan and permit. Cole points out a trade-off between cost and risk. The expensive dam could one day be useless if the lake disappears. But if they don't build one by the time trenching is no longer possible, the potential for flooding could be tremendous. Just like in Juno, there's a tension in time scales. What must be done now versus what can wait? And for how long? Back in Alaska, Leif Hamus is chief of the Civil Works Project Management Section of the Army Corps. He's looking at the options for Juno, including some tried in Switzerland.
I have jokingly called them the dark horse solutions are something of carving, draining, putting a pipe through the glacier, you know, draining Suicide Basin before it becomes a problem. And how that would even work, everyone's very fuzzy on still at this point.
And he says that any long-term solution will need to account for the potential danger of other basins farther up Mendenhall Glacier. In Lank, they only had to worry about a single basin. So reading between the lines, it probably won't be one of those dark horse solutions that saves valley neighborhoods. More likely, it'll be something below the glacier, at Mendenhall Lake, along the river, or both. And then there's the reality of actually constructing it, whatever it is. How much could a solution cost?
Hundreds of millions, I think, is a reasonable guess. But whether that's 100 million or several hundred million, I think, is way too early to tell.
And who will pay for it? Hamus says that's complicated. Usually there's some sort of a split between the federal and local governments. And of course, Congress has the power to step in and decide. One thing is clear. Folks living in the Mendenhall Valley are anxious to get it done, and they're pushing Alaska's congressional delegation to make it a priority. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan grilled Adam Tell, President Trump's nominee to be the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works, at a recent hearing.
And the Corps initially said when I went to him, said, well, Senator, we're going to work on this. We think it'll be 10 years to study and fix this. Say what? That is the wrong answer.
Tell assured Sullivan he could fix it quicker.
The Corps of Engineers was made to solve tough problems, and so I look forward to working with you, with the surrounding communities, to try to solve this challenge.
Great. Thank you. In an expedited manner, not 10 years. I mean, that's just...
In an expedited manner, Senator.
Thank you.
Expedited, because the flood happens every year. Valley residents fear the next one, and the ones that will come after, especially people who aren't protected by the temporary flood barrier the city put up this spring. If the government waits too long, will people feel pushed to move out of the flood zone? Could this danger melt away by then? What precedent is being set for how quickly the U.S. handles climate disasters? A sense of urgency is welling up from Valley residents. What are they supposed to do while they wait? In the next episode, we'll ask them, stay or go.
There's literally nowhere to go in Juneau.
This has the potential to be so devastating to our community that it will change the very nature of the city and borough of Juneau. But if we lose that level of homes,
there is not really a viable future here.
In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO. This series was the brainchild of Anna Canny and was funded by the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism. KTOO city government reporter Clarice Larson and I wrote this episode. Claire Strempel, Adeline Baxter, and Lisa Fu edited it. Dave Waldron is the audio engineer. The theme music is by James Crawford and Vance Westlake.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. You are listening to community-supported Juneau Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juneau, 91.7 Juneau Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. St. Vincent de Paul here in Juneau serves a vital community service in helping our town and its most vulnerable populations. And now it has a new leader in Jennifer Skinner, with former executive director Dave Ringel in a new role as special projects coordinator. They join me now. We're going to find out what that is, Dave. They join me now in Studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson, Gunath Chish, Wasiati. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And Dave, nice to see you again. Wasiati.
Thank you very much.
All right. It's nice to see you. Gunath Chish for being here. So let's talk about this transition that happened. I know you have a whale watch event happening this Sunday, mm-hmm. I believe it is. We'll talk about that in a
Next
little
Sunday,
bit.
Next Sunday, August 24th.
Oh, a week from Sunday. Yes. Right, right. So mm-hmm. the 24th.
Correct.
Okay, the 24th. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can go to the website and find out a little bit more information about that. And the website is, Jennifer?
SVDPJuneau.org.
SVDP, St. Vincent de Paul. That's how you
yep.
remember that,
yep.
right?
Yes.
The first letter of each thing. And I'm glad you didn't write that out on a website, you know? St. Vincent
that
de Paul.
That would be lengthy, right? Yeah.
That's so funny. That's the website. You can find out more information there. You can also find out about everything else that St. Vincent de Paul does, but we're going to talk about a little bit about that, because when did this transition happen? I don't think I knew about this until recently. So tell me, Jennifer.
It has been recent. The formal transition happened July 1st.
So, July 1st.
Yes.
Okay. And so was this something that had been like in the planning? Like, did Dave hire you knowing that he was going to, that you were eventually going to take over?
Oh, there was hopes for that, but we definitely followed the correct procedures on how to interview, hire, and all of that for leadership roles like that. So,
Jennifer had been working with us with another agency as a case manager, and she's an excellent case manager. When other opportunities fell through for her, I created a position to continue to utilize her services and watched her see the servant leadership mentality that St. Vincent de Paul believes in. And we've worked together for almost 2 years, and it's been a natural transition. She hasn't run away from any of the challenges. and she's got a good feel, and she's got unique skills. As I get older, you know, I'm turning 46. Nope, I'm turning 64, even though I think I'm sometimes 46. And it's sometimes good to get new blood. And we've had some difficult transitions in our organization when Dan Austin died, and it's much better to have a coordinated leadership transition where, as special projects coordinator, I can tie up loose ends, remember where the skeletons in the closet are and get rid of them before she finds them.
Right, right, right. So let's remind folks, Jennifer, what does St. Vincent de Paul do?
Great question. A lot of folks in our community believe that we are just a thrift store, and that is one primary role we play in the community, and that resource directly funds all of our other programming. We have five buildings in our community of low-income housing. On our campus, where our offices are located, one of our buildings is a senior living building. And then we also have 21 units of transitional housing units, which allow for folks to kind of gain traction, work through our programming, and get ready to be in more permanent, stable housing. That we partner those folks up with our Navigator program, which also helps drop-in, walk-in folks that need help looking for housing, getting all of those barriers to housing addressed. Some of the simple things that we maybe don't think of every day is that it's really hard to get a job when you don't have an address to put on a job application. It's hard to get into housing if you don't have an ID or your birth certificate. So those types of things, those are some of the key areas that we focus on in the Navigator program.
How do people find you in terms of, you know, if they need services, how do they get referred to you?
Some get referred, for sure. Most of the time they either call our office, but more often than not, they show up in person on our, what we refer to as our campus, which is off of Teal Street. We've been longstanding neighbors in the Teal Street area. It's also where our transitional housing is, our freeze store. We host the Sobering Center on our property as well. We partner with the city in efforts to provide that service as well. And then, we get a lot of walk-ins.
So it's like probably like word of mouth, right? Somebody who's maybe used the service, maybe had a problem with housing and used this transitional housing and then said, hey, go there, right? In terms of getting the word of mouth out.
Sure. We really pride ourselves on the support network within the community that we support, as well as we have a lot of folks that we have provided assistance to that come back around and want to work for us or volunteer for us. It's really an interesting full circle, if you will.
Dave brought, I think it was Charity, a couple years ago on the program, who had used the service but then started working for you.
So we definitely try to support those who have been in services with employment opportunities. We're definitely consider ourselves a second chance employer as well.
Yeah.
We try to look past some choices that might have happened in someone's past to give them that opportunity to grow and spread their wings and become what they would envision themselves be in our community. We really focus on meeting the person where they're at and addressing those needs on an individual basis. And then, of course, we hope to place everyone in our transitional housing programs into permanent housing. They have 24 months to do that.
That's a good amount of time.
Yeah.
And so it gives people a ramp, right? A ramp up.
Absolutely.
In addition to the transitional shelter, we have three other buildings, which are low-income housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take people with vouchers that might not be able to find any other place. And oftentimes, because we have a relationship with them from our shelter, we know what it takes to keep them successfully rented.
Mm.
And that relationship can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Often we're referred to as the landlord with a heart.
How many people work at St. Vincent de Paul?
We have under 25 employees usually, unless we're operating the cold weather emergency shelter, which then bumps it up by about 10 or so more employees. So.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. And here's a lighter question,
because
we talked about the main services, but I think do people get confused often and use the plural Pauls as opposed to St. Vincent de Paul? Because Paul's is like the possessive, right? The St. Vincent de Paul's thrift store, right? But it's really St. Vincent de Paul is the name of the organization, right?
It's based on the patron saint of charity of the Catholic Church. It just so happens that the Archbishop of Anchorage, Juneau, Andrew Belisario, is a Vincentian priest.
Mm.
And he is the national episcopal representative, which meant that in June, the National Board of Directors came to Juneau, Travel Juneau helped us out. They got to see Juneau. They got to see what we do. We are a conference, which is the smallest level of organization within St. Vincent de Paul, but we are the largest conference in the United States.
Mm.
And I had national vice presidents looking at what we do and just amazed at how much a very small group of people can do. We have volunteers in our home visit team.
Yes.
That go out and they meet, they go out in pairs and they meet with people. Sometimes what is needed is aid, and if we can't provide it, we might know the program that can. Sometimes we just help an elder clean a house because they're in danger of being evicted for a housing inspection. And we can keep this person housed not by giving them money, but by providing a little bit of service, making sure their house is ready for inspection.
Our home visit team is based of consists of volunteers, and they go out two at a time to the person who's requested the service. So they go meet them at their home and really just share that love, and they really try to meet the need but address more than just that basic need. They try to see how they can honor our mission in its entirety. And that involves that spirituality side of it, where we blend the two. We honor our mission in all that we do. We always ask ourselves, is this mission? We want to make sure, you know. But also, you know, the works that our home visit team do is incredible. They really are the voice of our agency in its live action every day, because they go out into our community. You know, a lot of the other things we do in our organization is office-based and kind of behind the scenes, if you will, but they really do hold the face of our agency.
I can think of two home visits without revealing identities. We had one where there was a Facebook page where somebody was asking for electric blankets for a neighbor, and it discovered that they weren't heated. And there was a there was a plumbing company that went in and fixed the boiler, but we went and did a home visit, and it turned out he was an elderly gentleman who had a dog, and he needed prescription medicine, so we helped. And the next time we visited, the dog had died, and we were there to help him take care of his dog. And it, we didn't spend donated money, but we were there to be present with the person who needed somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great service. So, Jennifer, going back to you, what brought you to this sort of work? I mean, I know this job was specific a couple years ago you started, but let's go back to, like, what brought you to sort of social service area?
Well, my degree is in social work, and I have been in Juneau for 9 years and in nonprofit in Juneau for 9 years.
Congratulations.
And thank you. Thank you very much.
A nonprofit career path. I know it well.
Yes, of course you do. And so, you know, just helping others, that is where my heart lies, is spending my time doing good works and making sure that others aren't going without is really what keeps me going. And
where did that start for you? Like, why did you decide to get a social work degree? Where did it happen for you as a kid?
Oh gosh, yeah, I would say I've always been a giver, just by nature, and so I really enjoy helping others. I think that, you know, I've had a life of ups and downs, as we all have, and I think all of those experiences have led me to becoming more fulfilled when I serve others and I help them in a, in a sense that, you know, propels them into their next good step, right? I love the concept of accountability partnership, and we definitely foster that in our programming. I see such a need to walk with people, and maybe there's some truth to you fill the gaps for the things you didn't have when you were younger sometimes, and so I definitely see the need to be able to connect with others, to be a support person, whether it be staff or direct support, which I don't get to do that much anymore, but do enjoy training our staff and our volunteers on how to engage and learn to grow within our organization as well.
What were you doing before you worked at St. Vincent de Paul?
I was a licensed psychiatric technician.
Licensed psychiatric technician.
Not before St. Vincent de Paul, though. This was before I came to Juneau.
Before you, okay. And what brought you to Juneau?
My kiddo and her dad was in tourism up here, and so we shared custody. So
I see.
Came up when she started entering school age, and We've just been here ever since.
Nice. And where did you come from?
Central California.
Central California. What part?
Specifically Coalinga.
Coalinga. Okay, great. I grew up in that area, so I'm curious.
Fresno County.
All around that area, yeah, when I was a kid. Yeah. So that's interesting. And what was the adjustment like for you coming to Juneau? We're just trying to get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, no, Juneau is the most beautiful place I've ever seen. Mm. As you are aware, Central California it's either agricultural or it's not very green.
right, for sure.
It's pretty much brown. So it was really a shift, you know, not only climate, but just the beauty. I jokingly say to a lot of people, it's like living in a postcard. There's really not a place that you turn that's like not pretty. So, you know, that was really intriguing. I love outdoors. I love fishing. I love hiking. I really enjoy all of those aspects that Juneau has to offer.
So it sounds like you're in it for the long haul, at least for now.
Yep.
And so when you think about where St. Vincent de Paul might be in 5 to 10 years, what are you hoping to, you know, obviously Dave's leaving behind a legacy. He grew the organization. Yeah. A lot of things changed under Dave's leadership. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's still around, you know, that's also interesting too, because sometimes that's hard, right? Because they have thoughts about what you should do, but you are also taking the reins, right?
Yeah,
so it's like, get out of here.
I keep telling Jennifer it's in my best interest for her to be successful because the alternative is not what I want.
Absolutely.
So what do you see going forward? What do you want to have happen?
I just wanted to see us continue to honor our mission. Obviously, there's going to be continued needs, especially in the current climate that we're all experiencing. Mm-hmm. I want to see us be able to keep helping those that are most vulnerable within our community and help them reach that next step. And that next step, you know, seeing the success stories is what keeps us all going.
Mm-hmm.
I see us potentially, you know, expanding housing and services and just building upon what the foundation that we already have set forth and just continuing to address our community needs and meet them the best we can.
I can't see, you know, a future, at least in a short term, where housing isn't an issue in Juneau. Like, the cost of living in Juneau is so high.
It is.
It just seems like, are you seeing or experiencing more people having issues with housing?
Oh, yes,
we
definitely.
We have about $8,000 in rental assistance requests this month, and usually we don't get that type of need until the spring when tourism money is. So there is a growing increase. I think there's affordable housing and there's low-income housing, and that low-income housing is not affordable, and affordable housing is not affordable for low-income housing, and there's got to be a way to bridge the gap. And we provide some of that with our LIHTC housing and our housing units, but every time we take somebody who's homeless and find a housing unit for them, we got to find another housing unit for the next person.
Hmm.
Yeah, there was always a wait list for all of our services, housing and transitional housing included. There's no shortage of need in our community.
So, and as Dave mentioned, you know, you get a lot of rental assistance need. And so one of the things you do is you have fundraisers and you try to find ways to bridge the gap, as it were. I'm sure you're funded in different ways, foundations and such like that, but also relying on community support. And
absolutely.
So you're having is it a whale watching tour?
Yes, it is.
And this is going to be on Sunday, August 24th.
Correct.
Okay.
From 2 to 4.
And it's probably, I'm going to guess it's donated to you.
It is. And we're so gracious to our wonderful contributors, Alan Marine, for
Alan
sponsoring
Marine does great.
This
oh, they're
event.
Awesome.
They are without folks like Alan Marine being on our sides in the nonprofit sector, you know, we wouldn't be able to have some of these really great events that are unique, you know. I mean, how many places in our country can say that they hosted a whale watching event?
I know, right?
Juneau specifically, yes, quite a few of us. But, you know, the cause is so good. And I think the one thing that we do that's a little bit unique is that we offer folks that maybe can't attend the whale watching tour to go ahead and purchase a ticket. It supports us. It supports our programming and all the good works we do. But it also supports those who otherwise don't get a chance to go on a whale watching tour.
Oh, so I could buy a ticket and then somebody else could go on the tour.
Absolutely.
We have people who buy tickets and donate them, and then we will get some of our residents. Last year we had an 89-year-old on his birthday go on the first whale watch of his life.
Whoa, yeah. That's so cool.
I think it's really interesting fact to point out that a lot of the folks that we serve in our low-income and transitional housing, even though they might be lifelong residents in Juneau, haven't had the opportunity to go on some of these tours because they cost a little bit of money. And, you know, when you're picking between paying the lights or, you know, extracurricular activities, that's kind of
a
no-brainer, right?
Sort of like pay it forward, right?
Right. So if you can't come, that's okay. Send someone else, you know?
And, of course, we can get information at
svdpjuno.org.
And that's where you go to find out more information about the whale watching tour, as well as all of the services that St. Vincent de Paul offers. And I have some stuff down in my car to donate. Could you take it for me today?
Happily. We'll happily take your things.
It's hard for me to get over there at 10 a.m., but that line is sometimes so long, but it's a great service.
It is a long line.
One of the things, and change is happening, we are open at 10 a.m. every day from Wednesday through Saturday.
Yes, mm-hmm. For donations.
And we try and do it every day. So even if there's a long line, come back the next day. And there are still people who think we only do it 2 days a week. So Thursdays and Fridays are really...
Are those the times to come, Thursday
they're,
or
they're
Friday?
They're not as big a line.
Well,
a
they
big
were hint the times there. To come.
A hint now. Of course, tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Dave Ringel, Jennifer Skinner. Congratulations on your
thank
new
you.
Position and happy almost retirement.
Almost.
Dave.
He's nearing the finish line.
He's nearing the finish line. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Let's have a little Thlinkit Word of the Week.
You're listening to KTOO's Thlinkit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley. And the word this week is gagan.
Gagan.
That means sun. And here's a sentence.
Gagan is et yikt a wirach.
The rabbit is sitting in the sun. Let's hear it again.
Gagan.
Sun. Gunesh Jish to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Bessie Cooley is Kokhetan and a child of a Yen Yedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series. She is currently translating projects for the Children of the Taku Society.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
We'll do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Okbe 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives over on KTO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you, never more important than now. And Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Grass, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gonna cheese.